Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, we've been studying a book from the Pali Canon, which is called the Sutta Nipata. It's a collection of mostly of verse works, which come from a very early period of Buddhist literature. We've been going through a representative selection of texts in this work. And now we come to two suttas, two discourses, which deal with two major events in the early life of the Buddha. For those who have the book, we're on beginning on page 46, and those who don't have the book will be getting handouts. You've already gotten handouts. The first of these two texts is called the Pabbaja Sutta, which means the going forth. That is the going forth into homelessness. And this sutta or text deals with an incident that took place in the early period of the Buddha's life after he renounced his life as a prince and started on his quest for enlightenment. The incident was an encounter that took place, a meeting between the king of the Indian state of Magadha. This was the central Indian state in which the Buddha undertook his period of ascetic practice when he was striving for enlightenment, and the Buddha when he was not yet a Buddha but still a bodhisattva, one who was striving for enlightenment. And what's interesting is that this sutta has come down in the form that most of us know it in Pali, the Pali language, in this text called the Sutta Nipata. And now just about 2 weeks ago, I've been reading through, in Chinese, the Vinaya Pitaka of the Dharmaguptaka sect, which is the sect whose Vinaya, or Book of Discipline, has been established in the Chinese tradition. And the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya has an account of the early life of the Buddha. And as I was reading, I came across the story of the Buddha's encounter with King Bimbisara. And then there were some verses relating that story. And as I was reading these verses, they looked very, very familiar. And then I realized where they were from. And then I took the Pali text and I compared it with the Chinese, and I saw that it was almost the same exact text, which had found its way into two completely different collections of Buddhist texts. The same poem had traveled southwards from central India, southwards to the countries like Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, into the canon of Theravada Buddhism. And then it had traveled to northwest India, where the Dharmaguptaka sect had been established. Actually, we say northwest India, now it's Pakistan and Afghanistan. And then from there, it had traveled northeastwards to China and was translated into Chinese. And we have the same story of the Buddha's meeting with the king of Magadha, King Bimbisara. And for those who read Chinese, I made a photocopy of this poem, and I tried to make a translation of it. There might be faults in the translation, since I just have a very amateurish knowledge of Chinese. Okay, to give a little background, the Buddha grew up as a prince of the Shakyan clan. The Shakyan Republic was in a state which is in northeast India. Now, most of it would be in Nepal. And his father, the state was actually not really a monarchy or a kingdom as we presently know a kingdom, but it was a tribal republic ruled by a council of elders. And so when we say that his father was a king, what this means is that his father was probably the chief of this council of elders. The Buddha was brought up in luxury, groomed to be the successor of his father. And when he was 16 years old, he was married to a princess from a neighboring tribal republic. And everybody expected him to succeed his father to the rulership of this republic. But when he reached his late 20s, he became increasingly reflective, pondering these great problems of old age, sickness, and death. And then, in his 29th year, he made a decision to leave the household life, to leave the palace, and go forth as a wandering ascetic, a homeless ascetic, living a life of meditation, of spiritual practice, in order to seek the way to enlightenment, the way to liberation, the way to the state which is beyond birth, old age, sickness, and death. This is the state which is called nirvana or nibbana. In the Buddhist conception, the life we lead now is not the only life that we lead, but any single life is just one link in a beginningless chain of existences, each of which begins with birth and ends with old age, sickness, and death, followed by a new birth somewhere else. And so the cycle repeats itself over and over as long as one is in the grip of craving and ignorance. And it's been the conviction in India from time immemorial that there is a state, a transcendent state, beyond the cycle of birth, aging, and death, a state which is birthless and deathless, an unconditioned state. And it's been the great aim or goal of Indian spirituality to break free from the cycle of rebirths called samsara and to realize that state of liberation, that deathless state. And so when the Buddha, now we call him at that point the Bodhisattva, living the life of the palace, when he decided to leave the palace and go forth as an ascetic, he was not initiating something new, but he was following this age-old Indian practice of spiritual seeking, spiritual inquiry. And so the story that we meet, that we read about in this first sutta, begins at some point after the Bodhisattva has left his home republic, has left the palace, and after leaving his home state, the Shakyan Republic, in northeast India, he traveled southwards to the North Indian central state of Magadha, whose capital at that time was Rajagaha. The city of Rajagaha still exists today in the state of Bihar, with an almost identical name, Rajgir. And after settling in Magadha, the Bodhisattva took up residence on the slope of a mountain called Pandava Mountain, living in a cave on that mountain and going on alms round into the city of Rajagaha. And one day, while he was going on alms round in the city of Rajagaha, King Bimbisara, while standing in the upper stories of his palace, was looking down into the city, and he saw this wandering ascetic walking through the streets, and his manner was so regal, so majestic, that the king was astonished and attracted to this figure. And as we'll read, the king wanted to meet him and sent messengers to follow him and find out where he was living. And then the king followed him to his residence on the slope of the mountain and had a conversation with him. Okay, so now the sutta begins. The narrator of the poem says that he will tell about the renunciation, the way in which the one with insight, the one with vision, renounced the world, and the manner of his inquiry, which led him to choose the life of renunciation. Okay, now comes this, in verse 2, a theme which we meet many, many times in the early suttas, the early discourses, that the life in a home, in the household life, is stifled or crowded. It's said, we meet in the suttas, the statement that it's not easy to lead the pure spiritual life hemmed in a household. Since this dwelling in a house, it's said, to be like a path covered with dust. On the other hand, it's said that for the wanderer, for one who has gone forth into homelessness, the life is like open space. One lives in the open. One can move about at liberty, living one day in one place. The next day, one can continue walking, stay another place. One has no fixed residence. Each day, one just has one's alms bowl, one's robes, all one's possessions just in a shoulder bag, and one can move around freely from place to place. One has no commitments, no obligations on one's time. One is free to use one's time for full time to devote to this great quest to investigate and understand the ultimate nature of human existence, to investigate the nature of the mind, the nature of reality, and to try to find that state which lies beyond this impermanent, ever-changing, conditioned world. And so the Bodhisattva, when he was living in the palace, had such thoughts as this. And so one day, when everyone in the palace was asleep, in the middle of the night, he got up, left the palace, went beyond the range of the Shakyan Republic, and then gave up his royal attire and replaced it with the robes, the patched robes of a wandering ascetic, taking a clay bowl and from then on just wandering on alms round. And so in verse 3, we are told that he had now become a wanderer and he worked to purify his life. In everything he did, in all of his bodily deeds, and in everything he said in his speech, he avoided the unwholesome and the bad. Actually, the Pali says, Kayena papakamang vivajayi vachi duchari tung hitva ajivang parisodayi. That he purified his bodily action. He abandoned verbal misconduct and he purified his livelihood. So these are three aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path: purifying right action, right speech, and right livelihood. And then on that basis, he devoted his time and energy to the purification of the mind. Okay, and so now in verse 4, the text says that he, the Buddha, but actually at this point, he's not yet really the Buddha. It's speaking propyleptically, I think the expression is, with reference to the future. The one full of noble characteristics walked about in search of food, and he came in time to Rajagaha in the state of Magadha. Okay, now as he is wandering on alms round, the king of Magadha, Bimbisara, stood on the upper story of his palace, and he just happened to be looking down in the street, and he saw the Bodhisattva wandering from house to house on alms round. And since he was a king, just intuitively he was able to spot one who has royal characteristics, a royal manner. And so he calls out to his attendants. And this is where the verses that have come in the Chinese pick up. Almost exactly, word for word, the same. Look carefully, friends. He is handsome, shapely, of beautiful complexion. His gait is pleasing, with his eyes cast at only a little distance. With downcast eyes, he is mindful. This is the proper manner for an ascetic wandering an alms round. In fact, this is like one of the training rules that comes down for the monks. When one wanders on alms round, one is supposed to be keeping one's eyes downcast, looking only a yoke measure ahead. A yoke is about 6 feet ahead. So the eyes are cast down, looking only that distance ahead. If one has to look up to see where one is going, one can. But one doesn't go glancing around to left, to right, looking up and around out of curiosity. But the senses have to be collected and drawn inward, because one is practicing mindfulness, keeping the mind collected, focused on what one is doing. Okay, as the king noticed his manner of walking, then he observes, he does not seem to be from a low family. Send out the palace messengers to find out where he is going. Okay, so the king sends out messengers to follow the Bodhisattva, so that the king will know where he's staying, because the king wants to go to visit him. Okay, and now, as the messengers are following him, they notice that the Bodhisattva is walking on alms round. The text says in Pali, sapadanang charamano gutadvaro susangvuto. Here, this expression, sapadanang charamano, has special meaning, which the translation, it's difficult to capture the meaning exactly in translation. What it means is that one goes on alms round from house to house without passing over any houses, without picking and choosing. Like there's a practice sometimes when monks or ascetics go on alms round, one might think, this looks like a wealthy, prosperous house, a house of an affluent family. They probably have good food. I'll go for alms round here. But this house looks disheveled, poor, not well kept. People don't seem well mannered. I'll skip over that house and just go to the houses of, look like houses of well-to-do people. So that's the kind of, we call it, defiled way of going an alms round. There are some people who do that, but the ideal way for going an alms round is to go without discrimination, sapadanam charamano, without picking and choosing, but one goes out of compassion for the people, thinking that one wishes to benefit the people by going an alms round, whether they're wealthy or poor. And this is an important aspect of Indian spirituality that I have to explain. It might seem to a Westerner that when the monk or ascetic is going on alms round, that it is the person who is giving the food that is benefiting the ascetic or the monk, and that it is the ascetic or monk that's getting the benefit from the person who's giving the offering. But for the Indian mind, it's just the opposite. Because the ascetic is one who has renounced the world to seek enlightenment, or in some cases, it could be those who have reached enlightenment. And so the ascetic is the one who partakes of the highest spiritual realization, either by having attained it or by being on the path to its attainment. And the ascetic gives up any means of self-support, gives up all means of remunerative employment in order to devote himself or herself fully to this quest for enlightenment, for liberation. And so the ascetic represents, we can say, the way transcendent values, transcendent reality, emerges within conditioned reality, becomes expressed within conditioned reality. And so when the ascetic goes on the alms round with the open alms bowl, this is the way in which the ascetic, the mendicant, monk or nun, is giving people in the world the opportunity to participate in that quest for enlightenment and for liberation. This is the way the ascetic, the mendicant, is enabling people in the world to acquire the spiritual merit that will help them advance on their own path to enlightenment and liberation. And so when a monk going on alms round chooses to go on this non-discriminating alms round, opening the bowl, presenting it to everyone and anyone, without distinctions, without preferences. It means that that monk is giving everyone and anyone a chance to participate in that quest for enlightenment and liberation. It means that they are opening the bowl so that anyone, by making an offering of food, it can be an offering of plentiful, rich, and sumptuous food. It can be an offering of just a spoon of rice, a piece of bread, a banana. Even that simple little offering is helping them to accumulate some merits which will go into their accumulation of meritorious karma, good karma, that will help them advance along that great journey to final liberation. Okay, and so now the Bodhisattva goes on his arms round. He's well restrained. He's guarding the sense doors. That's an important quality of the ascetic on the arms round, because the senses are always looking for enjoyable objects to focus upon. And so one has to restrain the eyes from wandering to seek interesting and enticing forms, restrain the ears from trying to pick up bits of interesting conversation, restrain the nose, trying to catch smells of the food. Is it good food? What have they prepared for me? And going with Sampajano Patisato. He translates alert and mindful, clearly comprehending and mindful, fully aware and mindful. So these are all the characteristics, the qualities of an ascetic or a mendicant monk on alms round. Okay, and soon his bowl fills up quickly. Okay, and then when his alms round is over, then he sets off and returns to his place on the mountain, Mount Pandava. And so now the messengers know where he is staying. Okay, and so seeing that he was going to stay there, some sat down and watched while another messenger went back to inform the king. And the messenger goes back and tells the king that he's staying there in the mountain lair like a lion or a tiger or a bull. The Chinese mentions just two animals. It mentions just the lion and the tiger. It doesn't mention the bull. Then the king, when he gets this message, then he has his chariot prepared and he sets off in great haste to the Mount Pandava. Then when he arrives, he goes up the mountain, he exchanges greetings with the Bodhisattva, then he speaks to him and says, "You are only a young man, a lad in the prime of life. You are handsome and shapely. You appear to be a prince of noble birth." Then he praises him in various ways. And he says, "I will bestow wealth upon you." The king offers now to bestow wealth upon him so that he could come back to his state of nobility. But then the king asks him, "Please tell me what family you are from." Then the Bodhisattva answers that not far from the Himalayas, the land of snows, there is a country called Kosala. The people of Kosala are rich and they are strong. Now you see, the Shakyan Republic was at this time a tributary of the state of Kosala. The state of Kosala was a larger state which had its capital in the city of Savatthi. Then in verse 19, the Buddha says, my people come from the race of the sun. That was the Buddha's lineage was called the solar race. And their family name is Sakya, the Sakyan clan. That's why we call the Buddha sometimes Sakyamuni, the sage of the Sakyan clan. That was the people I left when I walked away from the wish and the longing for pleasure. Then in the last verse, he gives the reason for his renunciation. It's very, very nice in the Pali. Kamesu adinavang disva nekamang datu kemato padanaya gamisami etame ranjati mano. Having seen the misery or unsatisfactoriness of sensual pleasures, and having seen the security in renunciation, I will go now into the struggle, into striving. This is where my mind delights. He actually translates that same line twice. This is where my mind finds bliss. It's actually one line in the Pali, but he translated it in two ways. So this gives, that one verse gives sort of the key explanation to the Buddha's renunciation. Having seen that the pleasures of the senses are unsatisfactory, unable to give true lasting satisfaction, that they are impermanent, unstable, unreliable, and that as long as one craves for the pleasures of the senses, one remains locked in this ever-repeating cycle of birth, aging, and death. And that renunciation, the renouncing of the pleasures of the senses, is the path that leads to the transcendent state, to the state beyond the cycle of birth and death, to liberation, Nibbana. And so now the Buddha announces that he will go forth into this struggle, this striving, this quest for enlightenment. And that will lead into the next sutta, which is deals with the Buddha's struggle or striving. But I think maybe rather than go into the sutta right now, perhaps I should give our guests the chance to ask questions based on this sutta or any other questions that you might have about Buddhism. Please don't feel at all shy about asking questions. Yeah. He had one child, yeah. Yeah. Okay, that's a good question. Okay, now, some people in the West, not only the West, would be uncomfortable with the thought, how can he, as a young man, leave a wife who has just given birth to a child? It seems heartless and cruel. First, we have to remember that this was a ruling family. And in India in this time, families were extended families. And so their family was part of the extended ruling family of the Shakyan Republic. And so the wife and child would have been more than well taken care of. We don't find in the early texts the idea that the Bodhisattva was going forth with a... Actually, we do have this idea already coming, but it becomes more developed later, that the Bodhisattva is going forth with a world mission or a cosmic mission, not just to find his own path to enlightenment, but to find it the path to enlightenment for the world. And so he would have been, I think, considering this thought in his mind as well, that he's not doing this only for himself, but also to find the way to enlightenment for humanity as a whole. Okay, he spent 6 years striving and struggling on his quest for enlightenment. After his enlightenment, word had spread till it came to the Shakyan Republic, to his father, that his son has now become a spiritual teacher, has become the one that they call the Buddha, the Enlightened One. And so his father then sent a messenger down to invite him to come back to Kapilavastu, the capital city. And so then, together with his monastic order, he went back to Kapilavastu, to the capital city. When he went back, by this time his son was 7 years old, and when he went walking through the city, his wife and the child were watching him from the palace. The wife called the child to the window and said, "That is your father walking through the city." And the child, whose name was Rahula, said, "Even the shadow of that ascetic is pleasing to me." Then the wife said to the boy, "Go to your father and ask him for your inheritance." I don't know what the wife had in mind, whether she meant ask him for the royal inheritance, you know, the gold and silver and gems that he should be entitled to. But the little boy came up to the Buddha and said, "Ascetic, please give me, you are my father, please give me my inheritance." Then the Buddha turned to his chief disciple, whose name was Sariputta, and said, "Sariputta, ordain him as a novice." And so the son Rahula was ordained and became the first novice in the Buddhist monastic order. And then he eventually grew up and became an enlightened monk as well. And later, when the order of nuns was established, his former wife became one of the first Buddhist nuns. And also an important thing that has to be borne in mind in this case is that Buddhism works with the idea of rebirth. And so we accept the idea that this is not the only, of course, as I said, not the only life that we live. And the connections that we form between people generally are not connections that are formed in one life only. And especially the most intimate, most deeply personal connections are not connections established in one life only. And now, according to Buddhist tradition, the connection between the Buddha and his wife was not just a fortuitous connection which happened to arise in that particular lifetime. But the Buddhist narrative tradition tells us that this connection between the Buddha and his wife, her name was Yasodhara, had gone back many, many cosmic cycles. And she had formed a vow or resolution to always be reborn in association with him in every life when he is following his quest for enlightenment, and to be able to be of assistance to him along his path to enlightenment. And so now they came together in this last life so that even though from one angle as his wife, he would say that she was an impediment on the way to enlightenment, something that he would have to renounce. But she came to that position just so that she would be able to assist him on that way to enlightenment. Once one achieves enlightenment, that means the ending of the cycle of rebirths, yeah. Okay, if there's no further questions, then we'll end the discourse. We end with what we call the sharing of the merits. This is when we speak about the teaching, listen to the teaching, again we acquire some merits, and now we develop a wholesome thought of sharing these merits with various other beings, wishing that they will be well, happy, free from all harm and suffering. So I will recite some verses in Pali, and you just generate thoughts of goodwill to all beings, wishing for their welfare and happiness. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe sattā anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhyā.